It's Monday, May 15th, and the choice of one lawmaker could affect the choices for millions. We start here. North Carolina's governor vetoes a bill restricting abortions, but that veto won't matter without some help.
There could be other repercussions for them if they stand up to their party.
Now a handful of Republicans hold the state's future in their hands. Turkey's vote comes down to the wire.
We don't like this government, especially this president.
The opposition calls this a make-or-break moment for democracy. And it's tough to tell when the actual deadline is, but do you really want to find out?
Even as we get closer to that X date, there are risks to the economy.
Could President Biden really just take the debt ceiling fight into his own hands? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Since the Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court last year, in which virtually all abortion policy was turned over to states, it hasn't taken long to see how Republican-led states would react. At this point, 15 of them, nearly one out of three states in the union, have effectively outlawed all abortion services.
I'm proud to be called America's most pro-life governor.
These are states, of course, where a vast majority of lawmakers agreed. Well, now, at this point, we start getting into the territory of, what about a state where legislators want to do one thing, but the governor wants to do another? What about places where the parties are split? And in this era, without a national right to abortion, these rules can change from one election, even one week, to the next. And so in North Carolina right now, we are seeing how just one or two people can alter the abortion landscape for millions of women.
Babies are not burdens. They are the biggest joy in our lives.
Last week, the Republican legislature in North Carolina passed a bill banning most abortion procedures. On Saturday, the Democratic governor vetoed it. That might not be the end of the story, though. ABC's Ann Flaherty's been watching all this play out. Ann, what's going on here?
It's a really interesting story coming out of North Carolina, Brad. We assumed that North Carolina was just going to stay essentially blue and protect abortion rights. And that's because, of course, you had that governor, the Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, who said he would veto any abortion legislation. But then one thing really interesting happened. It was a Democratic female legislator there who she ran on abortion rights. She even talked at one point about obtaining her own abortion after a medical emergency and saying it's only between me, God, and my doctor. It's none of the business of the chamber. She flipped parties.
The party wants to villainize anyone who has free thought.
Out of the blue, so she's open to abortion restrictions. Mm. Now, she's not doing interviews. It's a bit of a head scratcher, but that flip actually turned the legislature there into a supermajority for Republicans. Her moving from the Democrats to the Republicans gave them that veto-proof majority. So, you know, everyone looking at North Carolina thinking that's a, you know, a Democratic administration that would veto anything, that doesn't matter anymore.
Senate Bill 20's extreme restrictions on accessing abortion care are oppressive and cruel to the women of our state.
So what we saw were Republicans passed a bill that would ban abortion after 12 weeks, with some exceptions. It's medical emergencies, cases of rape and incest up to 20 weeks, and then a life-limiting anomaly in the fetus up to 24 weeks. Now, as far as the South goes, that's fairly lenient when you compare it to states like Louisiana that just restricted exceptions for rape and incest.
This legislative body is choosing a path that is fundamentally silencing those who it would impact most.
But abortion rights supporters say this 46-page bill has a lot in it that would just make it much, much more difficult for women to access abortions. So they're trying to block it. Now, Cooper over the weekend vetoed it at a rally.
It will make abortion unavailable to many women, particularly those with lower incomes, those who live in rural areas, and those who already have limited access to health care. Therefore, I veto this bill.
There were lots of people cheering, and everybody was saying that they're very hopeful that this veto will be sustained. That on the surface, the Republicans have the ability to override that veto. Now, what's interesting is what we've seen in the past year, Brad, is that Republicans don't always agree on abortion. Mm. So we're looking at about four Republican lawmakers there who've pledged to protect abortion rights. And the question is, they just need one of them. Is one of them going to break with their party? and allow abortion rights to stay where they are in North Carolina right now.
But and yet, what does that mean for these Republicans? So you got Republicans then would essentially need to side with the Democratic governor. Is there a chance that happens? Or like, I can't imagine it's good Republican politics to be the one person that kept abortion legal in your state.
Well, certainly not if you're a Republican. And I think a lot of them looked to their voters and said, look, I support this 20-week limit that we have in the state right now. I don't want to push that back. Now, promising your voters that you would protect abortion rights and then standing up to your entire party to flip abortion rights, I think those are two very different things. I think you're going to have lawmakers doing some, quite a bit of soul searching, quite a bit of, vote counting, quite a bit of meetings behind closed doors with the Republican leadership, because there could be other repercussions for them if they stand up to their party in this way. I don't think anyone wants this vote. I don't think anyone wants to deal with this. But of course, many Republicans in that state say, look, we've been fighting against abortion rights for a long time, and this is our moment in history.
And so I'm wondering, if this does get overridden, if this new ban, this 12-week ban gets put into effect, what does that mean for abortion in the South? And like, if it seems like at this point, stuff can change where you live over the span of like, you put your head down for a weekend and all of a sudden laws are different.
That's absolutely it. And I think you only have about three states now in the South: Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina. I guess you could throw Virginia in there, very much a purple state. But those are the three states: South Carolina, Florida, North Carolina, that could flip any minute, I think, on abortion rights. And these are states where women from the South have been going.
Every time I'm in the health center, there is a patient, at least one, if not multiple, from all over the Southeast who traveled hundreds of miles to get their health care.
Of course, in Florida, we saw the governor sign a 6-week ban. We're still waiting for the courts to weigh in on that. South Carolina, it's just a very divisive debate that's happening in that state legislature right now. Five women have banded together to try to push more exceptions to those abortion bans. It's I think anything could happen at this moment. And then that really changes the picture of the South, because you would really limit where women can go to have an abortion if it's illegal in their states.
Yeah, when it's hundreds and hundreds of miles in any direction to get an abortion procedure. All right. Ann Flaherty, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, people are calling him a wannabe dictator, which made it even more surprising this vote is so close. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
There are many countries in the world who have tilted more toward authoritarian governments in recent years, who look less democratic than just a generation ago. But very few of those countries are as important to American interests as Turkey. Turkey literally bridges Europe in the Middle East. It's a member of NATO. It's got one of the biggest economies on Earth. And in recent years, under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, it's resembled less and less of a democracy and something more like what you might see under Vladimir Putin. Well, this weekend, Erdogan was once again up for re-election. The polls had grown close, the tensions had risen, and the ballots this morning are still being counted. Let's go to ABC's foreign correspondent Britt Clendett, who knows this country well. Britt, you lived there for a while. What are the stakes here?
The stakes are extremely high. Even when I lived there, Brad, several years ago, I could see that frustrations were growing around Erdogan, who was accumulating power, especially after a failed coup in 2016.
More than 150 people were killed and 1,000 plus wounded after the military took over state TV and declared martial law.
We saw him picking up more and more power and gaining more control in the country. So that's part of the frustration that's surrounding him right now.
We don't like this government, especially this president.
This is a very important election for us. But I'm hopeful.
It has kind of become this two-horse race and a vote of confidence for or against Erdogan. But his main rival is Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
We all miss democracy a lot. We all missed being united. We all missed hugging each other.
He's backed by a kind of broad opposition. You know, he wants to steer this, you know, NATO member country back towards a kind of pro-Western, more democratic stance. You know, he says he would kind of roll Turkey back to having a parliament and kind of reinstall some democratic institutions back in the country and reduce the power of the president.
Well, and so, Britt, last night, I mean, it looked like Erdogan was leading. At least that, those were the numbers coming out of the state news agency. Later last night, it appears this might be heading to a runoff. I mean, how dynamic has this race been over the last several weeks?
We do know that those early votes were coming in, being counted from the east, which are traditionally Erdogan, AKP strongholds. The numbers coming in from Anadolu Agency, which is state-run, that's given rise to the opposition saying, don't trust Erdogan, don't trust his AKP party. And that's why we've seen such a dispute over numbers and a divide. And really, this is a divided country. And the high voter turnout really goes to show just how people really want to be heard in this.
I see this election as a hope for my own future.
I want a world where everyone can live with certain freedoms without disturbing anyone.
I remember talking to a guest earlier this year, Britt, after the huge earthquake along the Turkey-Syria border. Our guests were telling us, like, this entire ordeal kind of threw into question the Erdogan era. Like, this says something about how this country has gone under Erdogan's rule. Why was that moment so significant? And does it say anything about how close these results are now?
Turkey kind of prided itself on being disaster prepared. You know, it had helped so many other countries when disaster fell on them, when disaster struck other countries. So there was a lot of discontent over the slow response to the devastating earthquakes, you know, that we saw in February. They killed 50,000 people.
When voting, we will take into account the pain we went through and the delay in government response.
Then there's the country's battered economic state. Annual inflation is something like 64%, unemployment at 10%. I think another big election sticking point, which we touched on before, is these allegations of oppression and human rights abuses by Erdogan. And I think that's something that's also come into play when people weigh up whether they're going to discredit his 20-year rule.
All right, that is Britt Clennett there in London. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Last week, of course, there was a big meeting at the White House where Republicans and Democrats discussed raising the debt ceiling, something they've never, ever failed to do. But that meeting came and went with no clear resolution on whether we will commit to fulfilling our financial obligations. And so now this week, there's a very real question of what happens if we don't. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze covers economics. She's in D.C. right now. And Elizabeth, we keep talking about the clock ticking as we begin this week, but that's kind of my first question. What are we ticking toward? Like, is there a zero hour when something bad actually happens on this very abstract debt ceiling debate?
Okay, it's not called the zero hour, but it is called the X date, Brad. And this is the date.
Wait, that's a real name, the X date?
It's a real thing. You can't make it up.
Wow.
This is the date. The X date is when the U.S., for the first time in its history, could default on its debt. It's a little bit of a moving target, this X date, because basically what it is a guess of when the government is going to run out of money to pay its bills. And what we've heard from the Treasury Department is that the X date could be as soon as June 1st.
We've been using extraordinary measures for several months now, and our ability to do that is running out, and we will start to run down our cash.
We also got a new estimate from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which looks at all these government spending, tax revenues. It takes a close look, and it said, there is a significant risk that this X date, that the date of a U.S. default, could be at some point in the first 2 weeks of June. And what we're seeing is this urgent effort to try to come to some sort of agreement to do that, but not a lot of progress to actually get it done.
Speaker McCarthy offered a very different way forward. He's proposed deep cuts that I believe are going to hurt American families.
I have not seen from there a seriousness of the White House that they want a deal. It seems like they want a default more than they want a deal.
One reason why we're talking about the clock ticking here so much is that even as we get closer to that X date, Brad, There are risks to the economy. There is uncertainty for businesses. We're hearing some small businesses talk about how this question of whether the government is going to be able to pay people what it owes is causing them questions about should they be investing their businesses right now? Should they be hiring? Mm. There are concerns from veterans who rely on benefits from the government that might get pulled if it can't pay its bills. There are 66 million Americans who regularly rely on Social Security payments. Right. They may not get those payments if the debt limit isn't increased. So as we get closer to that possible date of a default, the uncertainty in the economy kind of ramps up. You can expect that as we get closer to that date, if there is still no deal, we would likely see the stock market get a little bit more worried here. That could mean your 401k could take a hit. And just for context, back in 2011, when we got closer to that date, there was a big drop in the stock market. Even though a deal was ultimately reached, the credit rating of the government was downgraded for the first time ever. And that had a big ripple effect on basically how the rest of the world saw the United States. So just approaching this does have risks that shouldn't be ignored.
Yeah, and you think like 3 weeks, plenty of time to come up with a deal. And yet there's actually fundamentally less time there than you think. If you got this standoff, though, Elizabeth, between President Biden saying, raise the debt ceiling, no questions asked, and GOP leaders who are saying, we will raise the debt ceiling after you make these big spending cuts, what is Biden's play here? Like, is his only play to stand firm and hope the other side blinks, or are there other things he could conceivably do?
Well, there are a couple of things he could conceivably do without Congress, and unsurprisingly, we are starting to hear whispers of whether those are actual options. The president did not rule out the possibility of invoking the 14th Amendment, which sounds kind of crazy and extreme.
What is the 14th Amendment?
Okay, so I've been reading into this. Basically, I'm going to read you this section of the 14th Amendment that matters here. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law shall not be questioned, which basically argues that the government's debt cannot be put at risk, that the U.S. kind of credit worthiness is so important that if the president decides, he can go ahead and do whatever it takes to guarantee the public debt. And that would mean essentially the West Wing just decides to ignore this debt limit that's been imposed by Congress. They say, we're going to invoke the 14th Amendment. We're going to go on ahead and keep paying our bills.
Oh, and just like tell Veterans Affairs, like, yeah, send out the checks. Tell Social Security, send out the checks.
Like, you know what? I'm going to tell Treasury, you go ahead, you send out those payments. I have the authority to do this. The problem with that approach is that there would be legal pushback. And the president, pretty much in the same breath that he said his legal team was looking at this, said that it's probably not a solution this time around because you could expect that would be challenged in court. There would be this legal back and forth happening. And at the end of the day, that does not solve the problem that the debt limit is in limbo as that kind of legal process plays out. There's another kind of crazy idea out there called the $1 trillion coin. The idea being that the Treasury Department could just like mint this coin worth $1 trillion and use that to pay off some of its debt.
Oh, just say, like, we now have this money. We get to print it. We have it.
Yes. That option does not sound like it is a strong consideration. Treasury Secretary Yellen has previously said that's not a good option. And Brad, I'm not trying to be fear-mongering here in any way. And there is a lot of uncertainty around any of these estimates about what can happen to the economy if the U.S. does default on its debt. But the fact is, this is very different from a government shutdown. You know, we see these last-minute deals all the time. The government might even shut down for a day or two. But this is a very different situation. We're talking about the full faith and credit of the United States government, and that being put into question, not just for Americans, but for the rest of the world. It's hard to overstate how big of a deal it would be if the U.S. defaulted on its debt, something that's never happened before.
Yeah, which is why this week, every week up to this X date that you're talking about gets bigger and bigger. All right, Elizabeth Schulze in D.C., thank you.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, call it Eurovision, call it Euro hallucination, whatever it is. One last thing is next. And one last thing. It's like the Super Bowl if the Super Bowl was just a competition of halftime shows. The Eurovision Song Contest came to a conclusion this weekend on Peacock. If you've never seen Eurovision before, it's like as if the contestants on American Idol were representing their countries and that those countries had to write their own unique songs. Winning country gets crowned Europe's coolest and campiest creator.
In the simplest terms, it is the Olympics of songwriting.
That's ABC's Joy Piazza, who's been obsessed with Eurovision for years.
Like, I'm watching videos, you know, weeks before the contest starts. I have my own opinions about who I think should win and which songs are just too ridiculous for words.
This year, she traveled to Liverpool to see the spectacle up close, and the host location was actually perhaps more significant than any of the hosts on stage.
Last year, Ukraine won. A band called Kalush Orchestra won with a song called Stefania.
Traditionally, the winning country hosts the event the following year, only this year the broadcasters decided they couldn't send the rest of the contestants to a country at war.
Ukraine had their national final in a subway station.
Oh, wow. Like underground.
Like underground subway station, because it was just too dangerous to have it anywhere else.
And so these broadcasters decided to host it in the runner-up country of the UK, specifically in Liverpool. But in a city that's taken in thousands of Ukrainian refugees, organizers clearly wanted to make this feel like the Ukrainian home game it was supposed to be.
So it's the right place for this year's competition.
One of the four hosts was Ukrainian. Video packages included landmarks in London and Kiev. The official logo for the event included not the Union Jack, but the Ukrainian flag. And a duet performance between a Brit and a Ukrainian included real-life stories of fleeing Europe's biggest land war in a generation.
During this dance, they had this big projector of, like, text messages that were sent, like, "Are you safe? Yes, I'm in Poland." So in my travels in Liverpool, I talked to a couple of Ukrainian refugees.
We are music. We can send the message what's going on now in Ukraine.
They moved to Liverpool last year, right after the war broke out. They told me that they were moved to tears because of what they were seeing.
Cannot keep all emotions inside. It's just wonderful.
But this clear embrace of Ukraine only went so far. Organizers actually turned down a request for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to send a video message saying they wanted to avoid politics, which is kind of a tough sell when you've already kicked Russia out of the competition. Politics were on display here. But if it was all supposed to be about the music, the party of it all, well, the party delivered.
I went to a huge watch party in South London.
Is there anything you're looking forward to seeing?
Finland. After a few drinks.
When the winner was announced, it was like I was watching a soccer final.
Sweden took home the grand prize, tying Ireland for the most ever and cementing its place as a Eurovision dynasty. Remember ABBA's hit song Waterloo back in the day? That was created for Eurovision. Now the world also has a Swedish song called Tattoo. Sweden will now host the event next year, but as this showed, sometimes even when you're not at home, you can be treated to a homecoming. This was really the first year I'd ever watched my first full Eurovision broadcast. And just to explain if you haven't seen it, it's like as if the Grammys were being produced by RuPaul's Drag Race, which is to say, it's fantastic. But like if you're writing a hit song and you don't have a built-in techno dance break, like sorry, it's not getting on Eurovision. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.